Good evening once again to sisters and brothers in Dhamma, friends, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome once again to another public talk by Ajahn Brahm. We're delighted for him to be here with us for 3 days. Tonight, he'll be giving one talk, tomorrow, and also at the 21st anniversary celebration. I'm sure many of you would have heard of the whole furor over Ajahn Brahm's involvement in the ordination of Bhikkhuni in down under in Perth, Australia. How many of you have heard about it one way or another? Excellent. How many of you would say that he shouldn't have done it? Raise your hand. Shouldn't have done it? How many of you feel that, yes, he should have done it and he should continue to do it? Woo! And those of you who don't know what I'm talking about, please go to our website, buddhistfellowship.org, or go to our Facebook, Buddhist Fellowship Facebook, or to BSWA website, and you can get the entire story about what Papong has excommunicated Bodhiana Monastery as one of its affiliated monasteries now. And that is equivalent to excommunicating Ajahn Brahm. So what this means is that Ajahn Brahm can now start his own lineage. You know, it really amazes me. You know, the monks rely so much on women. I mean, if we don't feed them, we don't arrange talks for them, we don't give donations, or the mothers didn't give birth to them, where are they today? Huh? Really? So the next time you go to a temple or you go and offer dana, ask the monks, do you support Bhikkhuni ordination? Because if they don't, we really should consider diverting support. In fact, that was one of the Buddha's advice in his days, that if the monks didn't behave themselves, we should protest by not supporting them. Well, Ajahn Brahm can correct me if I'm wrong on that one. But there is also an e-petition going around, and I think all of us who feel passionate about this may want to sign up on the e-petition. And you could probably do a Google on it, e-petition for Bhikkhuni ordination, or go to the BSW website or the Facebook that I've actually sent an email out to everyone, and I'll update it again tonight, so you can actually participate in the e-petition. And this is going to be in time for the Abbot's Monastery of the Forest Tradition taking place in December, and it will be presented to them to show them what an overwhelming support there has been from around the world for Bhikkhuni ordination. And three of the famous people that I think most of us know would be Richard Gere. You will find his name, 1002 place in the petition. Uma Thurman and his father, Robert Thurman, who is a professor at the Columbia University, who's a staunch Tibetan Buddhist. So indeed, we're very proud to have our spiritual patron who has stuck himself out for this, because it's I would imagine it's an unpleasant experience, but nevertheless, he's not lost his sense of humour over this whole thing, because it's amazing, right? Some of these monks are so confident that next life they will still be born in a man's body. They'll be lucky, you know, they'll be born. So I think sometimes this is a very telling sign as to what the level of practice these monks or nuns are, when they can be so discriminating on form rather than on substance. And it is a very revealing event. So anyway, I don't want to hold up on who you've come to listen to tonight. And the talk is going to be managing anger. So Ajahn Brahm is going to tell us whether he got angry with all those, with this whole affair. So please join me to welcome Ajahn Brahm.
There's an old story about a monk, and he was practicing. This is an old story from the Chinese Mahayana tradition. But these days of Mahayana, Theravada, Vajrayana, we just don't care really which particular tradition it is. It's Buddhism, it's truth, it's kindness. So who cares what you call it? In fact, these days, most times people combine those three traditions, Mahayana, Theravada and Vajrayana, and of course you know what we call that? MTV Buddhism. And this particular story, there was a monk and he was very determined to get enlightened. And so what he did, he asked his abbot, and he said, "Abbot, can I please go off into an island on retreat for 3 years? There's an island not so far away from the temple, and it's so secluded. All I need was to build a little hut, but I will need some food. Would you be able to send an attendant over once a week, just with simple food, and I can cook it for myself, and there I can live in solitude, meditating, practicing late into the night, getting up early in the morning, so I too can be like a Buddha and be fully enlightened?" And the abbot thought and said, "Okay, I give my permission." So for 3 years, that monk was alone on that beautiful island as a hermit, meditating, practicing diligently. And after 3 years, he decided, he thought, he was sure, he was fully enlightened. So what can you do once you're fully enlightened? He decided he has to let his abbot know. But a good monk doesn't go up and say, "I'm enlightened." That's not our style. So he asked the abbot, and I asked the attendant, he said, "Next week when you come, can you bring me some parchment, some thick, high quality paper, and some good ink, and a pen," because he wanted to write some calligraphy. So next week the equipment came. And then he went into his little hut and he meditated for about 3 or 4 hours. And when he came out of meditation, he wrote a poem in 4 lines. And the poem was this: "The diligent monk, alone for 3 years, is no longer moved by the 4 worldly winds. The diligent monk, alone for 3 years, is no longer moved by the 4 worldly winds. Now, in monk speak, that means you're totally enlightened. And he's sure that the abbot would understand that. And especially because of his deep meditation, that calligraphy was like a work of art. And it was beautiful. So he had to wait for another few days for the attendant to come and visit. And he started to think, "I wonder what the abbot will say when he looks at this incredibly beautiful calligraphy," and realized that one of his students has become another enlightened being. He will probably put that beautiful poem in a wonderful frame and hang it in the main hall of the temple. He'll probably invite me to be the abbot of a big temple in the capital city. He said, "Oh, this is what's going to happen. I can teach and help thousands of people from now on." So when the attendant came, he gave him this parchment and had to wait another 7 days for the abbot's reply. It was a long time waiting. And when the attendant came, all the attendant did was to hand another parchment to this monk. It looked very much like his parchment. So he opened it up to see what the abbot had written. And actually it was his poem. But over the first line, "the diligent monk," the abbot had scrawled in a red biro pen the 4 letters F-A-R-T. Fart. And he looked at the second line, "alone for 3 years." And this time, it was in capital letters, F-A-R-T. And the monk was starting to get angry and upset. He looked at the third line. And this time, It was big red letters over the words, "is no longer moved." F-A-R-T, underlined. And the last line, "by the four worldly winds," a huge fart, underlined with three exclamation marks after it. And he thought, what the heck is going on? That stupid abbot, he's ruined my calligraphy. You can only do this once in your life when you've got really deep meditation. What's he doing this for? This is not right. That stupid old abbot doesn't know when he sees enlightenment. I'm going to teach that abbot a lesson. And he managed to call that attendant just before he left the shore. "Take me back to that abbot. I've got to sort this out." So he went back into the... Now, the first time he left the island, went back to the temple, went into the abbot's office, stormed into the abbot's office, slammed the parchment on the table. "Explain it, you stupid abbot." And the abbot was very calm. He stood up slowly, and he opened up the parchment over which he wrote these four rude letters, rude words. He said, "So, monk, you wrote, 'The diligent monk, alone for 3 years, is no longer moved by the four worldly winds. Yet, four little farts have blown you clean across the lake.'" And I love telling that story because it shows if you really have got your act together and you're enlightened, you just don't get angry, whatever happens. So no matter, this is actually how we test people out. If someone comes up to me and says, "Now, I'm enlightened, Ajahn Brahm. Oh, I'm just fully enlightened." And I look and say, you stupid person. You know, no one like you can get enlightened. And people get very upset. And if I don't get upset, "I'm sorry, but I was just testing you and you failed. Try again." So anger is never ever justified in this teaching of Buddhism. So we always look at anger as like a weakness. Not only anger just hurts us personally, but it never really helps solve any problem whatsoever in life. And you find that if there's any problem you have in life and you try and solve it with anger, what anger does, it just lights another fire and everyone gets burnt and the problem just gets worse. And what Angie was asking me about, say the problem with the bhikkhuni ordination. You know that recently we just finished a 9-day retreat for our Buddhist society in Perth. A few people were there. And last Sunday, it was only, 2 days ago. Last Sunday, as usual, I finish off the meditation retreats, which I do, with the spreading of loving kindness, of metta. Because we use all the power of our mind after many, many days in meditation. And we spread this beautiful power of love, forgiveness, kindness to as many people as we can. But I also ask, as you know, many of you would know who've heard me do a loving kindness meditation, I also ask you to take someone special, like a really, really close friend, and spread loving kindness with them, zap them with it, to drench them with it. And I was actually quite surprised at myself. The person who came into my mind when I was wanting a good friend, someone to drench with loving kindness, was one of the monks who was the most antagonistic against the bhikkhuni ordination, the one who caused probably the most problem. And I was so happy that there you go, there's a person who's causing lots of problems for me. But I thought, no, I'm going to sort of love them. Love them to bits. And I was really actually quite pleased with myself that, you know, that there was no anger or upset there. And that is the way to live a life. In the little book, Open the Door of Your Heart, there's a little passage there. It's only a little story. And it's a story that, why let other people control your happiness? Because it doesn't matter what other people do. Thank you so much. It doesn't matter what other people do. Know that if they upset you, if they get angry, if they shout at you, if they humiliate you, and you get angry back, then you've lost. You've done exactly what they wanted you to do, to get upset. So when anyone sort of tries to get me upset, I just say, nope, I refuse to get upset. I'm not going to allow anyone to control my happiness. I'm going to get happy no matter what you do. You know, that really upsets some people. But it's an important thing to know that you are responsible for your happiness and peace. And really, no one can make you unhappy. No one has the right to make you unhappy. And if you know Buddhism and Dhamma, no one can make you unhappy. They just can't make you angry. So whenever there's a problem in life, you know, you try and solve it. But solving it with anger just makes you not really see what you're supposed to be doing. Look, one of these stories. This is not in the book, but there was one of the BF dinners many years ago, and they tried to enact this particular story out, because this is one of the stories which actually happened in New York many years ago. You know, have you heard of road rage? Does it happen in Singapore? Ah, come on. It does. Anyway, this was in New York. And I'm not quite sure what caused this. But these two cars, or one car was following another, and the driver behind was very angry and upset. He wanted to get some revenge on the driver in front. And as it happened, they came to a red stoplight. So both cars were stopped. They couldn't go further. So one of the drivers, he just jumped out of his car and he went to the other car and started banging on the window, trying to break it to get in. And of course the other guy inside was really scared. He didn't know what this crazy guy would do. But fortunately he couldn't break the window, and the light changed pretty quickly. So the driver in the car sped off. And of course the guy trying to break in, he went to get back in his own car. But it wasn't locked. He left the door open with the engine running, and one of these street kids had jumped inside and drove off with his car. So he's left at the intersection, his enemy was running, was in the car going away, and someone had stolen his own car. And I thought that was karma. See, that's what happens when you get angry. You leave the doors open and you leave the engine running, and anyone, it's New York, anyone can get in there and steal your car. It taught him a lesson. If you have anger, something terrible is going to happen to you. Because it is bad karma getting angry. And you don't need to do that. A lot of times, why do we get angry? I always like to find out the whys of these things. Because then once you understand where it comes from and why it happens, then you realize that you can actually solve the problem. So where does anger come from? Anger starts from frustration. You know how hard it is in life, you know, with work, you know, getting on in the company, your boss doesn't like you, your teachers humiliate you, your husband cheats on you, your wife doesn't look after you, your kids don't do well at school, your parents tell you off and you can't marry the person you want to. Oh, life is just so hard. And you know, I thought that when I become a monk, it'd be easy. You know, no one will tell you off at all. And I know what's happened to me. My monastery has told me off. So it doesn't matter where you are, you're a monk or you're in the world, whatever you do, there's always people going to criticize you and tell you off. But it all comes from frustration. You work really, really hard and life does not live up to your expectations. Husbands, wives, they're not quite as you expect them to be. And work, whatever you do, life is frustrating when we have unrealistic expectations. So let's get our expectations right. Before we get into marriage, we should read Opening the Door of Your Heart and the story of the three rings. You always know the three rings of marriage. What's the first ring of marriage? Engagement ring. Second ring of marriage? Wedding ring. Third ring of marriage? Suffering. Of course it's like that. Why are you laughing? Because it's true. Now, it's not just a joke, because once you understand that and accept that you don't get so frustrated when you get suffering in marriage. You know, yeah, I expected this. It's par for the course. There's nothing wrong with me. There's nothing wrong with my partner. It's just what happens when two people get together, they live close together. Of course, there'll be friction, there'll be heat, and sometimes we get angry at each other. If we don't know how to stop our frustrations. So, frustrations all come from expectations. And expectations is where we have the problem. So, don't expect so much in married life. Don't expect your husband to be perfect. I guarantee you, money back. He won't be. Don't expect your wife to be perfect. Absolutely no way. Put your hands up here, anyone who's got a perfect wife. That's it. No, don't do that. I'll take away that because you're in a very difficult situation. If you don't put your hand up, she'll really give you hell when you get home. And if you don't put your hand up, you're lying. But you know what it's like, you know, your wife. Do you have to have a perfect wife to love her? Of course you don't. That's why we love. Because what love is loving a person even though they're imperfect. Like I was saying, that monk who I thought of. You know, I don't agree with what he's done. He's caused me a lot of headaches. But still, it doesn't matter. I can still love him and care for him. Because I don't expect my monks or any monks to be perfect. I expect life to be like this. You know, when you do something, an old saying in Australia, you can't make omelette without cracking eggs. So whenever you do something good in the world, somebody's going to get upset. And that's par for the course. That's what happens in life. So you don't have many expectations. Otherwise, your expectations of life are more realistic. So you don't get frustrated. So say, oh, here we go again. Here he comes again. Husband having another argument. Wife getting upset again. So accept there's nothing wrong with this. This is life. This is realistic. This is what relationships are about. This is what work is about. This is what life is about. So where we can actually accept life for what it is, that's called insight. You know, insight is nothing fancy. You see when you get beautiful blazing lights in your mind and you see the truth and you see the impermanence and emptiness of all things. No, the real insights of life is actually seeing life as it is, your life and how it works. And once you have this, you realize that nothing has gone wrong, so you don't get angry. It's just, here we go again. Now, anger comes in two forms. First of all, it's anger to other people. But it's also, the worst form is anger towards yourself. And that's the most insidious form. So when you have problems in life, anger towards other people is when it all goes wrong, you get frustrated and you blame somebody else. You know, it's not their fault. They're just, you know, doing what they're doing and they can't really do anything else. Have you ever got angry at dogs barking when you're trying to concentrate? Why are you getting angry at dogs barking for? That's what dogs do. On a meditation retreat, we've got crows at our meditation center. When crows go, ga, 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 ga. You know the karmic cause of being reborn as a crow? If you go, ga, 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 to your wife, ga, 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 to your husband, you get reborn as a crow in your next life. So be careful how you talk to your partners. So this is what crows do. This is what dogs do. You know, what husbands do. What wives do. What bosses do. What monks do. But this is par for the course. It's life. So when we have this beautiful picture, oh, here we go again. This is what life. We don't have so many expectations. Then we don't need to get angry whenever there's a problem. So we don't, you know, blame other people. But the worst part of the anger is not blaming others. It's blaming yourself. You know how frustrating and depressing life can be? You work really, really, really hard at work and the other person in the office gets the promotion. Does that happen to you? You are so lucky. Well, think about it. You know, if you get the promotion, what happens? You get more money, yeah, but is it enough? No. You just get more stress, that's all. So you don't live long enough to spend the extra money. It's just a, what do you want to do in life? So many people, you know, they've got plenty of money, but they're poor in time. We haven't got enough time to enjoy ourselves. So, if you don't get the promotion at work, whoopee! Less stress, more extra time for me to enjoy. And those other stupid people, they can become the high flyers and become CEOs and give themselves a heart attack by the time they're 45. As for me, no, I'm just going to enjoy myself, have time, come to Buddhist fellowship, meditate, enjoy, go to have cups of coffee. CEOs don't have that opportunity. You're so lucky not getting the promotion. So when you look at it that way, you get a positive light in anything. So you don't get angry at yourself when things don't work out the way you wanted it to. So, oh, this is life. You can deal with this. It's no big deal. So, you know, whether it's, if I'm in trouble, if I get excommunicated from Wat Pa Pong, if I get excommunicated from Thailand, if I get excommunicated from the Buddhist fellowship, oh, then I can actually stay at home. I don't need to travel so much. Wonderful thing. If I get excommunicated next from the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, I can actually stay in my cave at last. You know, many people have actually visited the cave in which I live. I don't have enough time to live in it. That's why it's more like a tourist place than my home now. So I always look at it this way, that it doesn't matter what happens in life, both ways you can win. So because whatever happens in life, there's a problem, you go left, you go right, whichever way it works out, no, it doesn't matter, it all works out in the end. So I've got this wonderful attitude in life, it's just such a positive attitude, no matter what happens in life. Look, you know, you get sick and you die. Are you afraid of getting sick and dying? It's a shortcut to heaven. Why have to wait for another 10 years, 20 years, old people's homes, getting cancer, getting sick, having to wait? You can take the shortcut. Get cancer. Now, why get angry at the problems in life? Because whichever way it works, you can always do something about it. So, we get frustrated, and frustration leads to anger because of expectations. Not just expectations. It's all about this terrible thing in life called, you know, controlling. I've actually seen that. That's the main reason, you know, why we get frustrated. We try and control, control, control. We do our very, very best, and it doesn't work out because we think we must have made a mistake. We didn't control it the right way. You know, just in this bhikkhuni thing, one of the monks, I'm still friends with all these monks, one of them rang up and he made a wonderful question. He said, in hindsight, Ajahn Brahm, would you have done it any different? It was a good question. In hindsight, would I have done things any different? But straight away I said, look, I don't do hindsight. I gave that up a long time ago. You know the reason why? Because you look back, if I did it a different way, you don't know how it might have worked out. It's all just speculation, what might have happened if you'd have done something else. For example, if you'd have married a different guy, what would your life be like? Who knows? You can't really tell. There's no possibility of telling. What would have happened, you know, if you had have gone out with that sort of beautiful girl, instead of saying, no, I have to go to the BF this evening and listen to Ajahn Brahm. What would have happened? Who knows? You can't tell. That's why looking at the past and thinking what would have happened if is something which is stupid. And it's also wasting a lot of time. Because thinking, oh, what would have happened if, what should I have done? Look, really, you should be looking at where you are now and what you're going to do to make a very good future. So we don't get look back in the past and get angry and frustrated. Oh, at myself, I should have done something different. Why did I do this? I could have done it differently. I'm an idiot. I'm a fool. I'm stupid. And then you get depressed. There's such a lot of depression in the world today. You know what depression is? It's anger towards one's self and towards what one has done. It's guilt. And really, guilt has got no part in modern psychology. Why beat yourself up? Because, this is a weird thing to say, but I've never really met a bad person in my whole life. I've been to jails, prisons, and seen murderers, gangsters, rapists. And you think that these are evil people. They're not. I've never, ever yet met a bad person. And I've seen so many people. I've always seen a huge amount of good in everybody. Now look, this is a story. I'm not quite sure if you've heard this before. But it just comes to mind. When I was visiting prisons and teaching there, spent a lot of my early life in Australia teaching in prisons. And there was a couple of prisoners there in jail for drug dealing. And I know how much harm drugs do. Please never get involved anywhere close to that. It's not fun. It leads to a lot of physical and also mental imbalance. It's just not worth doing. But these two guys, they got into drugs and they paid the price, many years in jail. But just as they were last year in jail, I went to visit them. And one day, one of the guys, Nick his name was, he grabbed my arm and pulled me into the schoolroom, you know, where they were doing some classes in the prison. I didn't know what he was up to. And then he pointed to a board. And on the board were cards written by school children. Dear Nick, thank you for visiting our class. Please get out soon. Come and visit us when you're released. And he explained what had happened. Close by to that prison, a primary school principal wanted to do something so that her kids would not get caught into drugs. Because, you know, you have to get children at a very young age and teach them about the dangers of drugs. Because there's so many drugs around. Even in Singapore, even though there's a death penalty for people who traffic drugs, still they come in the country. Punishment and criminal laws is not enough to solve that terrible problem. So they wanted to do something. They were principal of a school. They wanted to do something to try and protect these children they were caring for. So they never got involved in this terrible, terrible life of drugs. So they thought, maybe we should get some sort of professor from the university, or some psychologist, or maybe a policeman. And they said, no. Let's get one of the prisoners who is doing time for drugs to teach these children what drugs are really like and what happens to you when you get into it. Who knows more, the professor or the person who's doing time? And so it was a beautiful, courageous and highly effective strategy. They invited two of these prisoners to come and teach their class of kids what it's really like. And what happens to you when you get involved in that? And these weren't people who were professors or psychologists, people who may have seen the results but didn't really feel it personally. These were people who had been hurt terribly by the drugs, the prisoners. And so when they taught these children, those children felt it. Never would they ever do drugs, those kids. And as for those prisoners, one or two days afterwards, in the art class, the teacher said, let's write some cards to Nick to thank him for teaching us about the danger of drugs. And the kids wrote all these cards. And when Nick showed it to me, he started to cry his eyes out, weeping and weeping. You know why? He'd actually done something good to help others. He'd hurt many people. And now he was paying off his karmic debt by helping others in a really big way. And that was just melted his heart. And he was crying and crying and crying in front of me. It was a wonderful thing. And not only did it help Nick, it also helped all those kids as well. Instead of getting angry by guilt of what one has done, do something about it. See if you can mend the harm which we've done in our lives, not by making more harm with anger, but with some social, kind, caring service. And you'll find you don't need anger anymore. Why get depressed, get upset, when there's another opportunity? So typically in Buddhism, we always treat guilt not just with forgiveness, but with positive forgiveness. Yeah, we've put aside what we've done, but you're karmically in debt. Pay it off by service and by helping. And to this day, I tell people, anyone who's got depression, one of the most effective ways of overcoming depression is not just taking drugs. It's not just meditation. Doing some social service. Caring for others. Making your life worthwhile. And that soon gives you a huge boost of inner energy and inner self-worth. Your depression vanishes pretty soon. You feel good about yourself. So instead of solving problems with anger, we solve it with compassion and wisdom and understanding. So if you've done something wrong, never get angry at yourself. Forgive yourself, but don't stop with forgiveness. Actually do something about it. Be a kinder, more compassionate person. Because I've never seen anybody who's a bad person. Everyone's got the seed of goodness inside of them. And because they have the seed of goodness inside of them, and you have that seed of goodness inside of you, please cultivate it and make it grow. And also help cultivate it in other people. So instead of getting angry at other people, just wear them down with compassion. Somebody just asked me that the other day, this evening. They said there was one of their friends that's grief-stricken because their wife died very young. I said, what should I do? He said, wear them down with compassion. Because compassion, after a while, becomes irresistible. Another prison story. One of the other prisoners which I was teaching him all these Buddhist stories about loving kindness, compassion, instead of getting angry. And afterwards, all the prisoners in my little group, about seven of them, they complained. You know, it is all right to complain to a monk, to say, what you said, Ajahn Brahm, is a lot of rubbish. That's what they say, because I love that. I get some feedback. But I can also argue back and say, no, it's not. Because I said, no, compassion actually works. And they said, it might work in a monastery. It might even work in Buddhist fellowship. But out there in your office, out there on the streets, in the real world, you have to get angry to solve problems. Is that right? And I said, no. So we said, let's prove it. Let's have a test. So I asked these prisoners, in this whole prison here, who's the person you hate the most? And straight away they all said, the second senior prison officer. They said, he's a dog, the worst kind. And I said, give me some examples. He said, it was a few days ago, one of the prisoners in the jail, his wife, who was financially doing it really tough, she managed to get a friend to give her a lift to the prison. And this was the first time in about 3 or 4 months she managed to get to the prison to see her husband. So she checked in at visiting time, and this deputy senior officer saw her. And before they could call her husband, the prisoner, to come to the visitor's room, the senior officer sent him on an errand to a part of the prison where the PA system didn't reach, on purpose. So he sent him to this area. So when the announcement came up, would prisoner say Smith, prisoner Smith, please go to the visitor's room, you have a visitor. He couldn't hear it. And the second officer knew this, but he wouldn't tell anybody where the prisoner had gone. And they asked him again, and after 5 minutes, the announcement, after 3 announcements, they tried to find him. When they did find him, the visiting hour was over. Bad luck. He just did that on purpose. You know, just to make life more miserable, both for this prisoner and his wife. He was a dog. So, I said, great. Now, do any of you in this group have any contact with him? And one of the guys said, yeah, actually, my part of my job is to serve tea and coffee. You know, tea time in the morning, at lunch time, in the middle of the afternoon. You know, this is like the English system. We always have morning tea, afternoon tea, and tea all the time. You know, that's one of the reasons why the British Empire, they lost their empire, because they were too busy drinking tea. That's what happened when the Japanese came to Singapore. They're too busy drinking tea, so... I know that, because I'm English. So anyway, his job was to make the tea or sometimes coffee. And I said, great. Now, this is the test. Every time you make a tea for that dog, make sure you put a lot of metta and love and care into that tea. Find out, you know, how much milk or sugar he really likes, what type of tea, how strong it is. Now really take care in that and see what happens. So I go every week, and every week I go there and said, anything happened yet? No, look, it's a waste of time. He said, I really put a lot of energy. I find out what he likes. I maybe find a biscuit, something he likes there, and I give it to him. Here's a cup of tea, sir, and I know it's the type you like. He totally ignores me, as if I just don't exist. And all that hard work and effort, he says, for nothing. So keep on going. It took us 3 whole months. Before we got our breakthrough. And it was amazing. He couldn't wait to tell me this. Because he gave a cup of like coffee. He may have got some special honey or something. To the prison officer. And said, sir, I made this cup of coffee and I managed to find some honey for you. I hope you like it. And the prison officer said, That was significant. That was amazing. That was the first time that prison officer acknowledged he was there after all those months. It was a crack in the wall. He knew that, I knew that. It would only be a short matter of time, and it was only about another month. He found a nice cup of tea and a special pack of biscuits. Here you are, sir. I found these biscuits. I know you like them. Enjoy it. And the prison officer turned around and said to the prisoner, thank you. And he told me that that went through the prison grapevine throughout the whole of Western Australia, and Australia too. Because you know, the prisoners, they, you know, go from place to place. It's like going from hotel to hotel. And you know, they get to know everybody, and the prison officers get to know all the prisoners. And so they got the grapevine there. They couldn't believe that that prison officer said thank you to a prisoner. Kindness wore him down. And I've seen that so many times. It does work. So don't try and solve the problem with anger. If you get angry to say, you know, your boss, because you know he's really misbehaving, he's really giving you far too much work that, you know, even Superman could do with his psychic powers. Even though, you know, your parents are giving you a hard time, whatever, or especially your mother-in-law. You know, mother-in-law, if you work it out, when you go home, write down the letters of mother-in-law. If you rearrange them, it actually does spell Hitler woman. It's true. Mother-in-law is an anagram for Hitler woman. But I remember this one story of this, this is actually from one of the Mahayana nuns. She told this wonderful story. She said one of her disciples, there was a girl, she married an Australian, and her mother-in-law just couldn't stand her daughter-in-law. And she was always, always angry at her daughter-in-law. Her daughter-in-law didn't know what to do. And she tried everything to please, you know, the mother of her husband. You know, nothing actually worked. She tried being kind. She tried sort of giving her some nice food, finding out what she liked. Nothing worked. So, you know, she heard about meditation, and so she did some loving kindness meditation and zapped the mother-in-law. That didn't work. So she tried some chanting, you know, trying to make that. That didn't work. And then she didn't know what to do. She was in the temple one day, and she saw the big statue of Kuan Yin. And then she was, no, she wasn't that, she was meditating, and a vision of Kuan Yin came into her mind. But it was Kuan Yin with the face of her mother-in-law. And that really shook her. But she got the message. You know, the goddess of compassion. She said, my goodness, my mother-in-law is the manifestation of the goddess of compassion. So what happened next? Next time she saw her mother-in-law, she didn't see her as the mother of her husband this time. She saw her as the goddess of compassion. And after a couple of weeks, the relationship had totally changed. And her mother-in-law was so kind to her daughter-in-law, just simply because she changed the whole perception of her mother-in-law from a Hitler woman to a goddess of compassion. And that actually was a beautiful simile of why, if we get angry at somebody, we actually make a monster out of them, and because we make a monster out of them, they treat us like monsters do treat people. So if you're angry at your husband, your wife, your parent, your children, your friends, your business associates, if you're angry at them, you're actually making them to be a monster. And then they will treat you like a monster. So, next day when you go to work, imagine Kuan Yin, and that's Kuan Yin with the face of your boss. And you'll find your boss will treat you totally differently. Try it and see. Because that way we're not solving the problems with anger. Anger just makes things far, far, far worse. And I know this is the story in the book, and this is a key story in that book. And I've used this story in just so many different situations. And this is one of the most powerful stories in that book. Psychologically, this is potent. And it's a story in the book of the demon, the monster who came into the emperor's palace. Now, I do keep on repeating stories, but people tell me every time I repeat it, people get something new in it. So this is the monster who came into the emperor's palace. And this particular story is based on the Buddha's own teaching in the Udana. Only I do sort of add a bit here and add a bit there. So once upon a time, a long time ago, there was a palace. And the emperor happened to be away on business. I think he must have been visiting the BF and giving a series of talks, I don't know. But anyhow, the palace was without its emperor. And so this monster, this really ugly, frightening demon, walked into that palace. And he was so horrible to look at, so terrifying, that all the soldiers and guards and people who were supposed to be protecting that place, they froze. They were terrified. And that allowed this monster to walk right inside the palace and sit on the emperor's throne. Sit on the emperor's chair. You can't do that. And all the soldiers and the guards and the ministers and servants there, they started to get very angry. Get out of here. Who do you think you are? You can't sit there. That's our emperor's throne. Get out. And at those few unkind words, that monster grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more smelly, and the words coming out of his mouth got worse. And that really upset everybody. Some of the soldiers got out their swords. Some of the ministers, you know, started raising their fists. Some of the lawyers threatened to prosecute. I don't know. But anyhow, at every unkind word, every unkind deed, even every unkind thought, that monster grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more smelly, and the language got more offensive. Now that had been going on a long time. When the emperor came back, he saw this huge monster. It was massive, taking up half the throne room. And he was so ugly, so frightening. Ugly Betty doesn't go anywhere near this ugly monster. It was so frightening, I often say that even with Steven Spielberg, with all the resources of DreamWorks, would never ever be able to sort of manufacture a monster that frightening. Have you ever seen Aliens? I haven't, but people tell me it's very frightening. But that was far more frightening than even the alien in Aliens. And as for the stench, The st- stink coming off this monster even made maggots throw up and vomit. And the language. The language there was worse than you'd hear in the pubs of Singapore when Malaysia beat them at soccer. But the reason why he was the emperor was because he was wise. He knew what to do. You know what he did? Did he solve the problem with anger? He said, "Welcome. Welcome, monster, for coming to visit me. Why have you waited so long to drop in? Has anyone offered you a cup of tea yet? We have Earl Grey. We have English breakfast. We have green tea. It's good for your health. How about peppermint?" And those few kind words, that monster grew an inch smaller, less ugly, less smelly, less offensive. And so everybody saw what was going on. They realized a mistake. They were trying to get rid of the monster with anger. And it was just making the monster worse. So, instead, they did what the emperor was doing, to give the monster kindness. A few of them went up to give the monster a foot massage. He had such a big foot, it took about 10 of them. Another one asked, "You want something to eat? How about a pizza? Monster size." And they were so kind to this monster that every kind word, act or deed, the monster grew an inch smaller, less ugly, less smelly, less offensive. And it seemed like no time at all, the monster was back to the size when he first came in. But did they stop? No, they carried on. Until that monster was so tiny, he shrunk so much with all this kindness, that one more act of kindness and that monster vanished completely away. And in the Udana, the Buddha called that monster, we call those monsters anger-eating demons. They feed on anger. The more anger you give them, the bigger they become, the uglier, the smellier, and the more offensive. And that was such a beautiful psychological insight. Because so much of life are anger-eating demons. You give your mother-in-law anger, and she gets bigger, uglier, and the language certainly gets worse. You give your boss anger, he gets bigger and more offensive. Or the boss gives you anger. If you are bosses as well. If you shout at your workers, and you get angry at them, do you think they'd be motivated to work hard? Of course they're not. If you're a boss, you treat your workers with kindness, and you get far more work out of them. I mentioned this a few years ago. Actually, the first time was at a HR conference here in Singapore, and I was talent spotted at that conference to give a master class at a big HR conference in London about 9 months afterwards. And I told this story because I did some research and found there was a company in UK about 3 or 4 years ago called Farrelly and Sons. They were a building maintenance company. And that year they'd won a prize. And the reason they won a prize, you know, was because in 12 months they had trebled their turnover and doubled their profits. And I want to know why. You know how they did that? Just by a simple act of kindness to their staff. They banned all overtime. They made it illegal in the company to have overtime. And when you think about it, that just little bit of kindness, if your boss was that kind to you, then you'd want to work harder for them. If they're showing, yeah, we care about you workers. And if you get a boss like that, my goodness, you don't want to go to any other company. So staff turnover went to zero. And you all know in any business, staff turnover, if you lose a key member of your staff, you have to train another person. And that takes a lot of resources, finding them, training them, and getting them to actually to know all of the clients, customers, suppliers, or whatever, so they know the job. That is a huge waste of money. If you can keep your staff, you save a lot in your profits. And so how can you keep your staff? Obviously, by being kind to them, so they want to be there. Not only that, you know when you go to work, you take all the problems of your family and your health problems into the office with you. If you've had an argument with your wife, you have problems with your children, that's not going to do much for your work performance, is it? That's going to bring it right down. So by letting people have enough time with their family, by not having too much overtime, they could have a wonderful family life. They go back home, they feel relaxed, no sort of family problems, because they could spend time with everybody. They go to work the next morning, they feel refreshed, with a mind clear, not having to think about the work and think what they're going to do with their son who's doing badly at school and misbehaving. It's a brilliant strategy. So because they were refreshed, sure they weren't in the office as long when they weren't doing overtime, but they got more work done. Simply because they were more efficient. They'd rested, free of the family problems, so in 8-9 hours they were at the office, they got usually 12 or 13 hours work done in the previous situation. That's why double profits, treble turnover. Just kindness, it works. But if you're angry at someone, you stupid child, you haven't sort of come in the top 5% at school, work harder next time. Come on, be kind to your kids. If you're kind to your children and encourage them and say, wonderful child, you know, you didn't come bottom this year, just second from bottom. It's an improvement, well done. You know, actually, kindness actually works. Just encouragement. Because, you know, all poor performance, you know where poor performance comes from, whether it's in school, whether it's in the office, or whether it's in life, you know, with relationships or whatever, all poor performance comes from a lack of confidence. There's just somebody on the way up here, on the way from the airport, they said their son is trying to get into Cambridge, they had an interview, what's my advice? And my advice was just to be confident. Confident people go a long way in the world. If I say anything that's a key to success in life, whether it's getting a partner in life, it's not being beautiful, it's not being sort of handsome, it's being confident. You know, getting the job, getting well in life, confidence. Where do you get confidence from? If everyone's getting angry, you're stupid, you're ugly, you're hopeless, you're dumb, does that give you any confidence? So the confidence is actually building people up. So we don't give anger when people fail. We actually give confidence, you know, by sort of praising. Well, you tried. Well done. It's amazing. You even got to the place of trying for Cambridge. It's amazing what you've done. You're an amazing person. If you teach people like that, instead of anger, praising them, giving them confidence, giving them kindness, you find actually their performance does increase. They do much better. And it's the same with you. Now, don't think ever you're a failure. As I said, I've never seen anyone who's not a really good, great person. They've got a wonderful seed in there. Be kind to that. Don't feed it anger. Anger just makes the demon inside of you get bigger. It makes the demon in other people get bigger. Give it kindness. Give it compassion. And there's no problem you can't solve. Early years in Thailand. It's one of the reasons I'm a bit disappointed that actually it's only a temporary sort of separation from my home one. These are my friends. It's where I grew up. This is nostalgia. So, you know, I'm sure that sooner or later they'll sort of accept me back again. But in the meantime, sort of some of those memories I have from Thailand. There was one of the prime ministers of Thailand, Dr. Sunya Thammasat. He was caretaker prime minister for about a year between a couple of the coups. And he was a very devout Buddhist. And I saw him afterwards. And he said something to me which I thought, what a shame he didn't stay as the Prime Minister of Thailand a lot longer. Because remember, this is a Prime Minister. A person, you know, the politics of Thailand, you know, the politics of any country is just very tough. And he said there was never a problem he could not solve by going to his adversary, his opponent, just the two of them. He said he put his hand on his opponent's knee. Now you can't do that in Singapore because I think they'll think you're gay. But in Thailand, putting your hand on your fellow person's knee is a sign of friendship. And just that sign of friendship and kindness, said once I've established that, there was never ever any problem we could not solve in politics. And he was sincere in what he said, and I thought, my goodness, in the realm of politics, such a difficult area where people's views and opinions, even though they have the best will in the world of trying to do something good for their country and their people, you know, people almost fight tooth and nail in politics. He said there's nothing they couldn't solve just by being friends with another person, just the two of them, and talking it through with kindness. It's a shame that I couldn't give an address in Copenhagen next week or in a few days' time to say, look, we're trying to get some environmental strategy for the future security of our planet. We argue and argue and argue, and a lot of times with anger. We'll never be able to solve that problem with anger. But would it be a wonderful thing if all those prime ministers and presidents, just them, not their advisors, would meet in a room and put their hands on each other's knees and out of friendship solve the problems of this world. That's what Dr. Sanya Tamasak taught me. He was someone who had many more problems than I'll ever have. And he could manage to do that. I thought, you don't solve problems with anger. The problems just get worse and worse. And you lose friends. And you give yourself so much tension and tightness, you get sick. There is other ways of doing it. With compassion and with kindness. So, I've been going on for an hour already, and I get into trouble if I go on too long. So that's got enough for you to think about for now. Now, are there any questions? So have the questions now? Solving problems without anger. Is that a good time? Very good. It also means I can take some oranges.
Thank you, Ajahn Brahm. Shall we give him a round of applause, please?
And if there's any questions from downstairs, I tell people that, see how crowded it is up here? Down on the fourth level, there's lots of space. Up here is economy class. In the fourth level, it's business class. You can stretch out.
Well, it's nothing like hearing from someone who practices what he preaches. And Ajahn Brahm has definitely not shown any anger towards his critics of what he has done with regards to ordaining the bhikkhuni, as I have witnessed this since the time it had happened. So even in the many conversations that had taken place over the bhikkhuni incident, Ajahn Brahm has not expressed any anger or hatred or ill will to any of these other monks. Okay, first question.
Yes.
Dear Ajahn Brahm, though I feel tormented by the daily grind, at the same time I'm not motivated to work towards seizing rebirth. Even the Buddha went through many cycles before he was enlightened. How much more would I have to pay and to work at it to get there? For this light at the end of the tunnel, how effective can I shorten the tunnel? Can I drop everything and come to you in Perth?
We know there's a similar question was once asked by this. This actually was a story from Sri Lanka. You know, there was this one man, his wife was a very devout Buddhist, and he just, when he went to the temple, only once a year, you know, for Waisak, it's what we call Waisak Buddhist. There's many of them around. So when he went to the temple one day, he heard the priest actually give a talk saying, look, as far as your next birth is concerned, or even enlightenment, it's all down to your last thought. Have you heard that before? So he thought, this is interesting. Now, what should I be thinking at the very end? And the actual priest said, the best thing you can think about at your death is the Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, the Triple Gem. So he asked the priest, that's all I need to do, just think about Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha, and I get a really nice rebirth? He said, yeah. He said, great, I don't need to go to the temple anymore. Don't need to keep precepts. You know, I don't need to sort of stop drinking whiskey. I don't need to give any more donations. All I need to do is to make sure, before I die, I think of Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha. So how can I do that? Because he had a shop. And he got a brainwave. Because he had three children, three boys. So when he got home, he renamed them. Eldest boy, Buddha. Second boy, Dhamma. Third boy, Sangha. Because he knew they'd be at his deathbed. Like children always were there when you die. So from that time on, he never went to the temple again, never listened to a talk, never gave any charity, never kept any precepts. Don't need it anymore. You need to do Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha when you die. He was sure. Ticket to heaven. But what happened? When he got old, he was dying. And of course, his sons were there by his bedside. And he was looking, Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, I'm going to heaven. Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, I'm going to heaven. And just before he died, Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha were here, I'm going to heaven. Hey, if Buddha, Dhamma and Sangha are here, who's looking after my shop? And that's when he died. So there is no shortcut. So just keep on practicing. And after a while, you just want to sort of just meditate and be still and be calm and be kind. When you just got no business anymore with the world's got no more business with you. And then you're out of here.
If my boss does not favor me, and has blacklisted me with no chance for promotion because I'm not the type of employee in her good books, what can I do? Feeling quite depressed over the job.
No, you're so lucky. Well done. You can just have a nice easy life in the job you're already doing. Don't ask for promotion. Look, I never wanted to be abbot. And as I was actually having a wonderful life as number two monk in my monastery until my abbot fell in love. Oh, that was a terrible day for me. So I had to take over. So if you want to be a boss, you know, you need to sort of have your head examined. It's much nicer being like a little follower, no worries, no problems. So just whatever position you are in the office, if anything, see if you can go down a grade. Much easier. And don't think about money. You never have enough, no matter how much you give you.
Okay, I'll give the worldly answer. I have 70 vacancies in my organization. So if you're really looking for a job, including administrative function, but mainly in IT area, can send me your CV. It's angiechu.mungsfield@mohh.com.sg. MOHH stands for Ministry of Health Holdings. Okay, or come and see me later.
And if she's an angry boss, you tell me.
Never angry. So I got zero turnover. Ajahn Brahm, are you enlightened?
Try and make me angry.
Next question. Ajahn Brahm. Anyway, he's not allowed to answer that, so don't waste your time. I always seem nervous, anxious, upset. What should I do?
What's wrong with being nervous, anxious, and nervous, anxious, and upset? Just enjoy it. So when you're nervous and you're anxious and upset, when you don't want to be nervous and anxious and upset, we call that in Buddhism double dukkha. Dukkha is suffering. Double dukkha is I don't want to suffer. So number one, enjoy it. Once you enjoy it, it disappears. Because once you enjoy it, it's like an anger-eating demon. You're giving it love and acceptance. So when you're anxious, just relax. When you're nervous, relax. When you're upset, relax. Do some meditation.
Relax. Dear Ajahn Brahm, I know I shouldn't get angry or frustrated, but every time I encounter an unpleasant situation by showing, and I show assertiveness and anger, I always manage to get things my way. People always pay attention to those who shout or assert themselves.
Only for a time. Because after a while you go shouting at people, so here she goes again. When's she going to shut up? You haven't got your own way because the problem keeps coming back again. That's why you think you have to get angry again to get your own way. And then it doesn't go your way, you get angry again. And in the end, you're going to die a very angry person. You never get your own way, especially when you die. I don't want to die. All your anger won't work then, believe me. So learn to let go a little bit more. And there's other strategies which are far more effective than anger. So try those other strategies. They're far more powerful.
You once said that understanding a person is the first step to not being angry. What happens when you think you've understood him, but does not agree with that person? Doesn't frustration come in?
Well, no, because there's only frustration when you think that you have to agree with other people and other people have to agree with you. I mean, there's so many different ideas about this world, so many different views and understanding, even about small things. We can see things, you know, in 100 different ways. So the idea is just to allow people to disagree with you. Now, I used to have, and I always tell, whenever we have disagreements, when we have friends, the reason we have a friend is that we allow each other to disagree. So I remember with my friends, we used to, in the days before I was a monk, used to go to the pub. I used to have these terrible arguments when I was a student, you know, about philosophy, politics, soccer, anything. But we had a rule that whoever won the argument had to buy the next round of drinks. Well, what it was, you know, that we were always going to be friends, because the reason we could have the argument was because we knew our friendship was stronger than any differences. So as a man and woman especially, husband and wife, you're never going to agree on everything. No way. The reason why you love each other is because you allow those disagreements. You say that our love is much greater than our differences. So, you know, you have disagreements, and if you want to know how to solve those disagreements, getting that, open the door of your heart book and get to the story of Chicken and the Duck. Chicken and the Duck story. Can I do it?
No.
No.
Too long. Please get the book. My sister-in-law is having a problem with her daughter who has turned rebellious and defiant towards her. She's grown up with a guy for some time against the wishes of her parents. This is the guy who has all the virtues I dislike. I guess they're not virtuous then. Yet my niece keeps seeing him despite her mother's pleas and even to the extent she kneels down to beg her to come to her senses. My sister-in-law, who loves her daughter so dearly, is so traumatized and depressed over this that she's contemplating suicide.
Ah, come on.
Your child is not worth dying for.
No, sometimes we do love our children so much, but in the end, you know, you have to let your daughter take her choice and do her karma, because you can't control daughters. Once she gets to that age, the more you try and control her, the more she's going to be going out with that boy. You should try reverse psychology. Just go and say, oh, I'm terribly sorry, daughter, it's the most wonderful boy you've ever had. And mother really approves of that boy. See, if mother approves of him, he can't be any good. Try to reverse psychology.
I have to take a question from fourth floor. If I expect a man to love me and he doesn't, should I dump him?
I expect a man to love you. You don't expect anything. So it's not that you expect him to love you or expect you to love him. Love is something which is beyond expectations, which happens between a person, not in this person or in that person, but between you. So it's something which has to be shared. If it happens within one person, then it can't be shared. So it has to be something which happens between you and them, not in me or in them. So if you see it in the right place, then you know whether it really is love or not. It's something which doesn't happen in a person, but happens between people.
My daughter hit me 3 times before I came here. First 2 times I forgave her, and I showed kindness and love. The 3rd time she hit me and stamped my feet. Is there a fine line between anger and discipline when it comes to children?
Okay, well, I don't know how old she is or how big your daughter is.
I think it's a child.
Sorry?
Young one.
Okay, if it's a young child, you know, it's obviously, I don't know, maybe she's upset that you're leaving her this evening. And maybe she's jealous that, you know, that you love Ajahn Brahm more than your child. So, find out the reason why she's upset. If it's a young child doing that, there must be some sort of jealousy or some reason there.
Lord Buddha hesitated in starting the bhikkhuni tradition, but for Ananda's sake and in his wisdom, he issued an edict that a bhikkhuni of 100 pansa would be lower than a newly ordained bhikkhu of one day.
Ah,
that's true.
Not quite. There's a lot of debate about this, and a lot of times people have actually done some more studies and really wondered the authenticity of that. And it really is because the respect which we have between each other, you know, that doesn't feel right. It never felt right. It would never feel right. The respect is always given evenly. Because one of the things which the Buddha actually said was that you don't respect a person for, you know, who their parents are, what clan they come from, sort of, you know, whether they're a man or a woman. No, you don't respect a person from where they came from. You respect a person for who they are. So they may come from like the lowest of castes, or they may come from the palace. They may be a girl, a boy, a gay, or physically deformed. That doesn't count for anything in respect. In the terms of respect, it's who you are, how you practice, your levels of kindness, generosity, wisdom, compassion. That's how we respect people. Whether you're a woman, a man, gay, or whatever, that doesn't count at all. It's whether you're a kind, generous, compassionate gay, or straight, or girl, or boy, or old, or young, deformed, or whatever. So that's actually how I think the Buddhist position is. Be careful, because when you look at Buddhist texts, sometimes you can focus on one particular point and forget everything else and take things out of context. And the other thing which many people have pointed out, that even before, just after Buddha's enlightenment, this is a story that Mara, who was trying to get rid of the Buddha, first of all, he tried to stop him getting enlightened. When he got enlightened, he said, well, you got enlightened, we'll give you that, but don't teach, okay, keep it quiet. So he didn't want anyone else to get enlightened. He said, no, I'm going to teach. Well, you know, teach for a year or two and then die. Get off, you know, go to Nirvana, it's a nice place, you know, just don't hang out here. The Buddha said, no, I will not pass away until I've established the 4 communities. Those 4 communities were the bhikkhus, the monks, the bhikkhunis, the nuns, the lay men and lay women Buddhists. He said, the 4 have to be complete before I pass away. So people have actually said, and it's accurate, from the very beginning, almost a few days after the Buddha's enlightenment, he planned to have bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, monks and nuns with equality in Buddhism. That was his intention from the beginning.
Ajahn Brahm, I thought Brahma Sahampati was the one who invoked the Buddha to teach. Before that, he wasn't.
Yeah, he invited him to teach, but it was, I think, Mara tried to stop him.
Okay, kindly comment on this. It's a study that's been published in Australasian Science. It's a Professor Joseph Forgas study that shows that people in negative mood were more critical of and paid more attention to their surroundings than happier people who were more likely to believe anything they were told. But sad people makes less gullible. Sad people are less gullible, improves their ability to judge others, and also boosts memory. Whereas positive mood seems to promote creativity, flexibility, cooperation, and reliance on mental shortcuts. whilst negative moods trigger more attentive, careful thinking, paying greater attention to the external world.
Come on. Am I a negative person? And I pay a lot of attention to the world. So I, personally, my life, I've got a very good memory, and I'm very attentive, and I do think deeply, so therefore, and I'm positive, I'm happy. So I refute that with my life.
And also, we can't believe all these studies, right? Ajahn Brahm, how do you explain death to children?
How do you explain death to children? Oh, it's just like, what's the death of children? Actually, you explain it like it should be, because sometimes never underestimate the wisdom of children. Say, look, a person has died, okay, so they're not going to be here anymore. So, you know, it's not just say your father's gone on a long holiday. Because actually children, why don't you explain it to them at a very young age, to actually embrace it, but explain it to them not with fear, with acceptance. This is part of life. That we're with each other for a certain amount of time, and explain it with a positive angle. What a wonderful thing it is that your grandfather was with you for such a long time. You were so blessed to have known him. Now he has to go to make way for other people in your life. But no, never actually, you know, just lie to your child about death. Because I remember I had a little budgerigar pet when I was a kid. And one day the budgerigar, the canary, disappeared. And I asked my father, and he said, oh, your budgerigar has gone on holiday. And I knew my father was lying. I knew he had died. I was smart enough to know that birds die. But I was very disappointed, and my father never trusted me enough to tell me the truth. And that was what really hurt. I'd far much better my dad had told me the truth, yet the budgerigar, he'd carked it, kicked the bucket, died, stiff. So that would be much, much better than sort of all this sort of rubbish stuff. Tell your children the truth, and I think that's probably the best way.
How could a teenager handle their anger towards their peers?
Anger towards their peers. Sometimes your peers are winding you up. They're pushing your buttons. They're trying to make you upset. So look, if those are your peers and they make you angry, number one, it shows your weakness. So, you know, just refuse to get angry. If they call you a pig, go oink oink. Whatever, make a joke about it, and straight away, you know, that there's no anger anymore. Humour is a wonderful way of overcoming anger. Any jibe which a person gives you, oh, you can always sort of give it back with humour. So no need to allow them to make you angry. And then actually they respect you so much. But if your peers are like that, they're always poking at you, upsetting you, then you're with a really stupid bunch of peers. You should come to the Buddhist Fellowship Youth Group, where we have a much higher quality. There we go. And guess who those guys are?
That's the youth group over there. Yeah. And I'm going to start doing a commercial for them. They're holding their next youth camp in the weekend of the 3rd and 6th of December. So Right. Do sign your children up, or if you're the young ones, go meet them tonight. They're really good looking.
Yeah.
How do you overcome anger towards a spouse who cheats on you?
Anger towards a spouse who cheats on you. They're already hurting you by cheating on you. Refuse to satisfy them by getting angry and upset as well. So tell them, so spouse, I am not going to get angry at you, but get one of these books in Mahayana temples, which have all these hell realms where people actually go when they cheat on their spouse. You know, and I've seen those books, they're not really real, but sometimes they're very useful. Say, look at this, husband. Look at this. Look at this. This is where you're going to go. You don't need to get angry. Just make you afraid.
I get a good lawyer. Dear Ajahn Brahm, your effort towards reviving the Bhikkhuni ordination is admirable. We support you wholeheartedly in this worthy cause. Is there any need for the fuss and commotion which was risen against your initiative, when the male and female forms are just external entities but reside, but inside this human body we're all the same, aren't we?
Yeah, I agree with you that it's just external forms, we're all the same. So if we're all the same, why can't we be treated the same? So I thought, yeah, let's treat everybody the same. And quite frankly, I was just looking after the four nuns we have in Perth. You never expected this to become such an international crusade, but now it is an international crusade. Maybe something good might come of it. And that's actually why I would encourage you to sign it. It's actually an I petition. So if you Google it, not E petition, no, I/petition. And you'll find it on Google, an I petition. And it's worthwhile doing that because it's got so big already. Let's make it, take it to the next level so it can actually change the position. Because it's getting close to that point now because it's in the newspapers, especially places like Thailand. Two very positive articles in the Bangkok Post. Now it's out there. Let's actually just use that. Because, you know, otherwise, one thing Angie told me just before, it was just after I had performed the ordination, she was going to a conference. It was a women's conference or something. And she said the one thing that she was embarrassed about, you know, with this type of Buddhism you see here, you know, coming from Thailand, was the lack of fairness for women. I think many of you have probably seen the same. And she said, at last, I can be fully proud of our monks. And so, now we've got that far, let's make other people proud of Buddhism. Let's actually make people in the West proud of it. Let's make people in Thailand proud of their Buddhism. And I think it's going to be a wonderful thing for Thailand, you know, to have, you know, both the women and the monks. Because look, there are many things which you will never ask me, which you would ask if I was a woman, if I was a bhikkhuni, you know, in these rows, but a girl underneath, then you would ask. And you know that. So there's only a certain amount I can do. There's much I cannot do. And if you had like a female form of Ajahn Brahm, what a wonderful thing that would be for each one of you. They could understand some of the problems which I will never understand. We do need both.
Dear Ajahn, my pregnant wife was found to be carrying a baby with a defective heart. And the doctor has warned her that this baby will be undergoing many operations for her in her entire life. The doctor's advice to seriously consider an abortion. She's now upset and depressed, facing a very important decision in her life. What do you think she should do?
Okay. First of all, that maybe tomorrow night's talk is about making decisions. I'll just give you a preview. A monk, an authority, a priest, any wise person should never make that decision for you. Because it's wrong actually to pass it to somebody else. And of course, how would I know what being pregnant is like? But what a monk or a wise counselor can do is help you make that decision. It is a tough decision. And first of all, whichever way you go, you will always be totally respected by me and by every other Buddhist who deserves the name of a Buddhist. Whichever way you go, and your family as well, just whatever choice you make to carry on with the pregnancy or to abort, please give that woman 100% compassion and support. It's the most difficult thing, and we don't want her to think that if I do abort, I feel guilty and people will blame me in the future. No, take away the guilt. And number two, it's one of those decisions, it's on the edge, it'll always be on the edge. As much information as you can possibly get about the condition of that fetus and the prospects in the future, because medicine does change. There are new techniques being developed every year. Keep that in mind, but if it really is going to be a very difficult one, and you decide to abort, that is understandable, that is compassionate, and you are accepted. If you decide to carry on, that is also compassionate, that is wise, that is accepted. Either way, it's a win situation for you. And as far as that fetus, if it doesn't make it this time, it will probably come back again and have another try in your womb. My usual simile is like you go to Changi Airport, especially on some of these cut price airlines, and you find that when you get there, the plane is overbooked, you get bumped off, you can't get on that flight. That's like being aborted. But if you do get, especially on SQ, if you do get bumped off a flight, you usually get a lot of money and also an upgrade on the next available flight. So if it is aborted, your child will probably get an upgrade in the next womb available.
Dear Ajahn, how do you dispose of Buddhist newsletters or pamphlets with the image of the Buddha on it? Is it all right to throw it into the rubbish chute?
That's a very good point. For me, this is my way. I always burn it because putting it in a rubbish chute, it doesn't feel right to me. So I usually burn those as much. For me, it's respectful. But really, it's no big thing. Don't feel that if you throw it in a rubbish chute, you're going to go and be reborn in hell for the next 4 years, or reborn, probably more likely, as a bug in the bottom of a rubbish chute.
We can put it in the recycling bin.
Recycling bin, that's a very good idea, because the Buddha always taught reincarnation, which is so close to recycling.
So you're not actually throwing it away, you're putting it in good use.
Yeah, right. Recycling is very good, yeah.
Some people believe in reincarnation. They believe that when a person dies and she has good deeds, there's a possibility that she'll be reborn into a human being again. Is this true or possible that my late wife will be reborn as a boy or girl to my granddaughter, and therefore one day she'll be my great-grandchild, and knowing that would be happiness for me?
Yeah, that happens. Now, one of the stories, a disciple over in Perth, Thai girl, she told me she could remember her previous life. She was born in this life in a village over in Thailand, up in the countryside somewhere. And she remembered her father from a previous life. Now, in a previous life, she had a son who did very well at school, and that son became the headmaster of the school. And she was reborn as the headmaster's niece. So her uncle in this life was her son in the previous life. Because that's what happens, we get attracted to the same families because of love and attachment. But she told me that because her memory of her previous life was so accurate, the whole village, they knew that, yeah, that was the headmaster's mother. So when she went to school, in Thailand, I think probably in Singapore, this was about 30 years ago, but certainly in those days, I'm not quite sure if it's the same now, when the teacher comes into the room, everybody stands up. Do you do that in Singapore now? Okay. But anyway, in that school, when the headmaster came into the room, she would stand up. She's only about 6 years of age. She would not stand up for her son. And the headmaster knew that. That was my mum. So the headmaster, no way could he cane her. She said she could do whatever she wanted in that school. And the headmaster, no way could she, could he cane his mother. How can you cane your mother? So she just had a wonderful time at school. Didn't learn very much. Well, that's sometimes a problem. It does happen. That was a true story. And so, yeah, it does happen.
Is having an expectation the same as having a dream? And is it wrong to have dreams and goals?
You always have dreams. But I don't think the dreams are going to work out. They're just dreams, that's all. But expectations, sometimes you might have this dream of marrying the most beautiful guy. But that's a stupid expectation. And it's okay to have goals, but make them reasonable goals. So what is your reasonable goal? To be rich? To have a wonderful relationship? What is the goal? Make it reasonable. And the most reasonable goal is to be wise and kind and at peace. Because sometimes having the perfect partner doesn't work out. Sometimes being wealthy just doesn't work out. Sometimes even being healthy doesn't work out. But you can always be kind. That's something you can always do, no matter what happens to you in life. You can always be generous, if you have got no money, with your time. You can always do that. And you can always make peace, no matter what is happening to you in your life. So have goals which you can achieve, whether it's health, whether it's even happiness or love or something. Sometimes those are goals you can't meet in this life. You can always have the most important goals of all: kindness, peace, and wisdom. Make those your goals, because those will always be within reach.
Why is it, as a Buddhist country, there seems to be so much anger in Thailand? Red shirt versus yellow shirt, and then they lose their ability to control their anger.
Yeah, that's such a very good question, because sometimes the Buddhism is on the surface. They go to the temples, and they sort of, you know, sometimes, quite a few years since I've told this story, they take the five precepts, you know, you have your hands up like this doing the five precepts. And there was one time I saw a person with one finger down. And I asked, what the heck are you doing? And they said, today I'm only keeping four precepts.
So it's an adultery day. Third one.
And then I saw people with all their fingers down. Now there's a lot of very wonderful people in Thailand, but sometimes when you don't get to the heart of Buddhism, you know, the meditation, the wisdom, the kindness, and sometimes there may be lots and lots of people say they're Buddhist, but you know, how many are really Buddhist? How many people really do take those precepts and understand why to keep those precepts? And why we don't get angry? Why we're kind? Why we're forgiving? Really, that would be wonderful, you know, if we could have not red shirts and yellow shirts, but striped shirts, a stripe of red, a stripe of yellow, and a stripe of red. So we can have like togetherness. But you know, sometimes that people get into positions and they're angry and they're upset. So that, you know, with the politics, the only way you can get some solution is to have some sort of referee, some umpire, like in a soccer match when there's two sides. And sort of, you know, sometimes people just don't ask for those referees. Really, it should be the job of, say, Sangha, of monks, to be referees. So, because we're not involved in politics. So what we can do is actually say, these are the principles, the ethical principles, which all political parties and all people following those parties have to follow. You know, truth, honesty, kindness, no corruption. That's basic principles. So that way, if there is like a third estate of like Sangha, monks and nuns, at least we can actually encourage sort of forgiveness, reconciliation, and just goodness, no corruption. That's something which we should be able to do. So really, we're asking, you know, religious leaders, whether it's Buddhists or Christians or Muslims, please put aside your differences and please actually take the high moral ground of ethics and show that as be leaders in society, to give good examples for other leaders, say in politics, military or whatever, to follow.
Dear Arjun, even though I want to lead a peaceful life, I can't pass a week without fighting with my family. My sis and mom are stubborn and I can never forgive them for what they have done to me. Why should I treat them with compassion?
Okay. You have to treat yourself with compassion, first of all. So, yeah, they've done things to you and it's really hurt. They may have even abused you, physically or even sexually. But if you carry on that hurt, then you're allowing them to hurt you again and again and again and again. What forgiveness means is not allowing that person to hurt you again. The old story, someone has called you a bad name. They called you sort of camel face. And you think, why did they call me camel face? They should not have called me camel face. They've got no right to call me camel face. And you realize they've just called you camel face three more times. Every time you remember it, they call you camel face one more time. Do you get it? So every time you remember the hurt which someone has done to you, you're allowing them to hurt you again. Don't do that.
I can't stand the sight of my colleague. She always annoys me and always shouted, and I always shout at her every day. I try to cool down each time, but I can't.
I should bring her to the next talk at the BF.
Tomorrow.
Sit down together, and I will sort out. Remember, put your hand on her knee.
How do you deal with someone who looks, who's continuously taking advantage of your kindness? Give more kindness?
Look, the BF has been taking advantage of my kindness for the last 9 years. And I give you full permission to exploit my kindness for the next 30 years.
Thank you, Ajahn Brahm.
Just think you're very lucky to have people like that you can give kindness to. So give them more. The more they ask for, the more you give. And then the more you'll have.
We only take an advantage of it, we expect something in return, right? Uh-huh. And that's the conditional giving, which is really not kindness.
Yeah, okay, that's very good.
You never expect anything in return from us. That's why you give it
from your heart. I expect a cup of tea and a glass of oranges.
I have a staff who's very negative about everything, complains about everything. She seems to exude a lot of negative energy. People ignore her so that they do not join her in her complaining. How to deal with such a person? Please write better next time.
Okay. Get all your workmates together and buy her a nice gift. For wonderful, in the Guinness Book of Records, you're the top complainer. No. Because sometimes when people actually don't realize just how negative they are, so your job is actually to praise her. So she hears what it's like to feel praise. And when she hears what it's like to feel praise and it gets inside of her, she will respect praise so much and kindness so much that she will start giving kindness back. Whatever you're given, that's usually what you give back to others. So sometimes it's because people are probably giving her a hard time all her life. So give her some kindness, give her some compassion and praise. And just like that prison officer, maybe it'll take her 3 or 4 months before you get a grunt out of her, but then a few weeks later, you get the thank you and the kindness.
In life, we can get angry in a split second, and in a moment when we lose our control and consciousness, what is the best and fastest way to stop being angry when you just can't control?
Okay, this is an old Zen story. Of a woman who asked a similar question of her favorite monk. He said, I always get angry so quickly. Can you please help me? And he said, yes. Have you got a mirror? Yeah, of course I've got a mirror. Great. Carry it around with you wherever you go. And when you get angry, hold it up in front of your face. And see what you look like. And she did that. She got angry, got the mirror. Ah! She was so shocked to see what she looked like. She was a monster. So it doesn't matter how many beauty creams and treatments and hair, money for your hair you spend, you get angry, you spoil all of it and get to be a monster. And according to the law of karma, if you get angry many, many times, your face gets stuck like that. That's why you become a monster in your next life.
In a family feud, when one person tried all ways and means to get the father's wealth, how do you expect the other siblings to forgive and still treat this brother with kindness?
Come on. I mean, all the wealth which you get from your father, that's money is not the wealth you get from your parents. No, it is the teachings, the example, the kindness and the care. That's what you inherit from your parents. Look, I didn't inherit any money from my father, but I inherited so much compassion and so much wisdom and so many good examples. And if you give your children wisdom and kindness and good examples in life, that's something which everybody can share, the whole family and friends. So don't think inheritance is just the money which you get when your parents die. Because that doesn't last very long anyway. What really is important, now, is the examples which your parents give. Now, the wisdom, I've already mentioned many things, but one of the things my father taught me, and again, I was only maybe about 12 or 13, and he came up to me one day and he said, "Son, look, please never steal anything. If you want something that badly, you're willing to go into a shop and steal it. Just ask me first, and I will buy it for you, no matter what it is." And he was really a poor man. When I heard that he would be willing, and I knew he was willing, to sacrifice anything, to borrow money, anything, to stop me stealing, there was no way could I steal. Because I realized from what he taught me how important it was to him that I wouldn't steal. He would sacrifice so much, anything, to stop me stealing. And I realized that. So I just couldn't steal. And that was a sort of inheritance I got from my father. And that's something which will never, ever run out. So, really, your children, forget about the money. That sometimes just separates your sibling, your children. But give them the inheritance of Dhamma, of kindness, wisdom, truth. Examples like that. And that's something which will never run out.
Final two questions. I find it hard to have no anger, and sometimes the provocation can be very serious. How many sayings do we have that if you slap on one face, you will give the other cheek? If you slap on one cheek, you give them another cheek.
No, that's stupid. If they slap you on one cheek, run like hell. Get out of there.
Last question. From the fourth floor, you mentioned in your book about a French philosopher who was quoted, "I think, therefore I am." You went on to say that he obviously wasn't a Buddhist. What did you mean by that?
He thinks too much. A Buddhist is nice and peaceful and calm. So again, all the thinking, all the ideas we have, that's what we argue on, that's what makes us angry. And differences of opinion. You know, okay, which is the best English EPL soccer team? You can argue on that, can't you? Which is the best country, Malaysia or Singapore? Are you going over the straits there, over the causeway and see what they say? See, he's already thinking about this, isn't it? Now, both are wrong, Singapore and Malaysia. Obviously, Australia's a business. So, but these are just, that's a new joke. When we think, we come to a conclusion, we think that is absolute truth, that's where we have all the arguments from. Where we don't take thoughts as absolute truth, they're just tentative opinions, then there's no reason for us to argue. They're tentative opinions, they're not conclusions, so don't fight over these things. Again, chicken and a duck story. Just because something goes quack quack doesn't mean it's a chicken. It's true that somebody actually gave me this article. That's an old story, it's in the book. Just because it goes quack quack doesn't mean it's a duck, it could be a chicken. Because apparently there was a chicken who was actually brought up with ducks, and it actually went quack quack. It was a real chicken which goes quack quack. So there you are, you think that all chickens have to go cock-a-doodle-doo, all ducks have to go quack quack, there's always these anomalies which are different. So all this thinking which you think you have to be right, Singapore's the best country, Malaysia's the best country, Australia's the best country, Buddhism is the best religion, blah blah blah, these are just thoughts. Don't think too much, feel. And if you feel that it's not right to get angry, why am I getting angry at the people I love and care for? Why am I getting angry at the people who just, you know, live just on the other side of a small body of water, who've got two ears and nose, eyes just like us? What's the difference? Why do we get angry? A Buddhist get angry at a Christian or a Muslim? What is a Christian? They know they never found any gene in a human body which is like a Christian gene or a Buddhist gene or a Muslim gene. So this is what we add on to things. Anyway, go on.
That's it.
That's it. Okay.
Thank you very much, Ajahn Brahm. Thank you.
And thanks to all those people in business class in level 4.
Indeed. Well, Ajahn Brahm just arrived today, so at the last part when he said when the chicken goes quack, he's pretty tired. So really we should let him retreat to rest. Well, once again, I'd like to invite you to become a member if you're not a member yet of the Buddhist Fellowship. And tonight, we're giving you incentive to become a member, or you can do it tomorrow, when you get one or both Ajahn Brahm's CDs of the last two talks that he came to give, which was Secrets of Happiness and Dealing with Fear and Guilt. You also get his special book that has not been published for sale, but is for people who sign up for free with the membership simply this moment. We are almost 4,000 in membership, so we certainly welcome you to help bring the numbers up of the Buddhist Fellowship, because it is in the numbers, whether you like it or not, that gives us the strength to grow further, to bring Dhamma to more people. So we do thank you for having come tonight, and we hope that you will either put it in the envelope or the donation as you exit, so that we're able to advertise to reach out to more people. You might have noticed an advert in the papers today in page 2 of the home section. And also to do many of our outreach programs, as we now have 5 full-time staff. Please join me to thank these wonderful people who are our staff that works to 12 midnight, 7 days a week sometimes. And also all these wonderful people in the yellow and the green shirt, they're our volunteers and our expo members in blue. They serve without expecting anything in return. You know that the one guiding the cars, trying to make sure the traffic is smooth, guiding you up here, managing the lifts. Please give them a round of applause for thanks. So tomorrow night, do bring along your friends. It is about making choices. And as you all know, we all have to make choices all the time. And do sign up for the BF Youth Camp if you qualify by age, or sign up with your younger younger members of your family. On Thursday, we are celebrating our 21st anniversary. If you haven't got tickets yet, we have a few left. So please do see anyone at that table. So with that, we'd like to invite you to all our programs that are published in our newsletter and our website. Please pick up a newsletter to exit, and also the free books, as well as check our website for updates, and sign on our BF Facebook. So once again, thank you, Ajahn Brahm, and we always have his guidance. And also his leadership to do what is right, despite being criticized by maybe his fellow monks who are probably slightly less compassionate. Let's give him a standing ovation. Thank you, Ajahn Brahm. Thank you. So with that, I wish you all a very good evening and the weekend coming up ahead. Thank you, and may you always be blessed by the Triple Gem, always be guided by the wisdom. Good night. Sadhu. Let's do it one more time, the Ajahn Brahm way. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Thank you. Thank you, and good night, everyone. Thank you. Thank you, Ajahn Brahm. Whoever is sparing Ajahn Brahm, can you please lead him downstairs so that he can go back to for his rest, please? Thank you.